This is Jolie Holland. Welcome to the Ghost Story Salon. Today, we're talking with my friend and collaborator, Daniel Edelston, about prison abolition. And we get into some pretty philosophical takes about art and all kinds of other things. Daniel Edelston is an anti-debt activist and filmmaker whose films include How to Reestablish a Vodka Empire and the upcoming Bank Job. He works on films with his wife, Hillary Powell, and he also put out a book in 2020 called Bank Job. All right, let's get into it. Daniel, how are you doing?
Good, thanks, Jolie. Yeah, very good. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for being on the benefit for Abolition 2021.
It's an honor to be asked. You know, I'm really pleased to be considered to be on that with you. You know, and I've noticed, you know, since we've been sort of friends and hanging out, how hard you work, you know, for a sort of more just and progressive society, really. So there are so many areas of injustice, effectively, you know. So sometimes one wonders, well, where do you start? How do you start dealing with these problems around you? You know, and I have a huge respect for you because you're continually working hard, and it's not easy to be a musician or an artist of any kind at all, but to also really try and dedicate yourself to helping the world beyond what's already helpful, which is the art. You know, I have a huge respect for it, and I feel like you know, kindred spirit, you know, although I'm sort of working in different areas, you know, sometimes. But
that's very generous of you. Yeah, I've always seen my music as the mouse in the corner of the cartoon making a joke about it all, that like allows hopefully a space to create a different way of thinking about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that, but I think you cannot separate an artist from their story, you know, and I think the story has to be so intrinsically connected. It's like, you know, the question, you know, who are you? Where are you from? You know, what are the shaping factors of the narrative? What are the, where's the kind of pit moment? Where are the lows? Where are the things, you know, I guess the obstacles which you've had to respond to, you know, and so the story and, you know, the overarching story and then the music itself are, for me, all entwined, you know, so it's not necessarily that, you know, about lyrics in the song you know, or any of that. It's the actual whole essence, you know, so I just see your essence as telling a story, you know, and the story develops between songs or albums or whatever, but overall there's a narrative like thrust, you know, and for me that's it's a kind of, well, when I first started listening to your music, I was thinking like, really, this is like an alternative story of contemporary America, you know. You know, that's what I was feeling from the music. On the one hand, there was like sort of traces of nostalgia in there about what the American song or the American literature was from the kind of beat period, which we never actually knew as artists. We were never alive during that time, but there were traces of like memory or engagement with that time. But then it was refracted through the lens of like the 2000s, you know, the early 2000s as well, and those realities. What's it like to be someone who cherishes that cultural, that countercultural moment, but to also be thrust into this kind of, you know, different period where actually the values of the beats and everything are in retreat, you know, and we have a sort of like very late and quite unpleasant period of capitalism, you know, and to be, I mean, you guys in America, you've just lived through like one of the sort of most extreme, I mean, I would never have thought that America would become as fascist as it has been, I suppose, you know, in the last little period of time. So what's it like? You know, the question is like, what's it like to be an artist and a thinker and a doer during a period like that? You know, so it's no wonder that you're finding, you know, all like en masse that the need to be political, you know, and the need to abandon, you know, that idea that artists somehow, you know, should conform, you know, or not question, you know, the dominant sort of political discourse.
My friend Boots Riley reminds me every once in a while that everything is political. And then I think about this Ta-Nehisi Coates quote where he calls white people the dreamers, you know, lost in this capitalist dream and like just imagining ourselves as these temporarily out of luck millionaires who, you know, are just about to get back on our feet so that we identify with the billionaire class and carry water for them. But that dream is also political. That dream anesthetizes the people around us. So what does it look like to wake up? And, you know, I've always wanted my music to serve this purpose of just helping people feel, because you can just get lost in that dream. And it's a shitty way to live.
Those feelings that you were just expressing remind me of the situationists. Like, it's going to sound pretentious, my pronunciation, but Guy Debord, you know, the writer who wrote about the society of the spectacle. You know, we're all so busy being caught up looking at this sort of thing that we are slightly asleep. You know, a lot of, I suppose, the work that we try to do is pulling away at that fabric as well, a bit like what you just said, trying to wake people up to think about things, or the other thing is like in The Wizard of Oz, you know, like pulling the curtain back and just looking, and it's just a little man, you know, with a big boombox, you know, shrieking things. But actually, when you peek behind the curtain, you find, oh, it's actually not so scary, you know, in a way, it's all made up.
I always felt like, as a woman on stage, that nobody wanted complex stories from me. And often, like, press didn't respond to what I thought was my most important or direct work. And they were more interested in, like, love songs and things like that, which is disappointing, but that's the culture.
And that might be a whole different set of inquiries in a way. That's that might be more about, I mean, which is something very specific to you, which is about being a woman in music, you know, and about maybe the structure of like male fantasy storytelling in journalism, you know, for instance, like you said, like they want a simple story and they want a simple, you know, they want a simple story about women, you know, don't they? But I mean, I'd love to read an essay, you know, about that from you, you know, to hear what you have to say. What the hell do I know about it?
You know it from like a less traumatized perspective. It's just it's an intractable set of stereotypes. So no, you, of course, your perspective about it, it's valuable. I mean, it, you know, just like James Baldwin tells us, white supremacy is our problem. As white people, you know, we're the ones who are best positioned to do anything about it. And male patriarchy is a male problem. And so men are the ones who are best positioned to change the system and to act as allies. And of course, you know, we need to listen to the people who are harmed and accept leadership. But we also, you know, need to be a lot more proactive and use our privilege wherever we can. My friend James says I should love you anyway, and that's okay. But ooh, yeah, you're making it hard for me. Ooh, you're making it so hard. I'm curious what the American mass incarceration looks like to you in the UK.
To me, that seems horrifying, but I don't have like direct experience. I only have what I've seen in documentaries and fiction films and then read in the press, really. But I know that there's within the kind of documentary film world, there's a lot of films that are doing their best to reveal how terrifying and unjust and just plain awful the prison system is. Yeah, so those are my types of impressions. And then like the worst part of it is that, or the most recent piece of research that I sort of remember reading was showing how many more Black people were being chucked into prison, and how that kind of closely, it's almost like the prisons sort of stood in for the slavery plantations up to a point. You know, they sort of, it became a replacement for that.
There's nowhere that's a clearer picture of that than Angola. And, you know, that's its longstanding nickname. It's Louisiana State Penitentiary. People can go in for short sentences and stay for 70 years, just working, you know, doing this forced labor. It's just like, you know, working people to death. And of course, with COVID, that became a lot more clear. Like, people were threatened. If they didn't want to go to their job in the prison for which they got, you know, they get paid pennies, that they would lose their chance to go up for parole, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think what you're doing is great, because clearly it's massively needed. And I think it's, yeah, in a way, it's the most extreme end of the sort of system of injustice, you know, and I guess it's the most extreme form of racism left, the last mm-hmm. vestige of it.
I grew up in the shadow of this prison. They had a really well-known rodeo, like a well-known and extremely brutal rodeo. So, you know, all rodeos are brutal, and, you know, you take the kids to the rodeo and you might see animals dying on the fairground. You might see like people getting really badly injured. And, you know, my perspective as a young vegetarian definitely plays into that. I keep flashing back to how I first heard about Angola. And
I was wondering about it. Like, what drew you to this like specific thing? Because we're so, you know, there are so many terrible injustices, you know, what I was thinking the same thing. So yeah, tell me more if you're up for it.
So, I mean, I didn't start this idea at all. So the pastors of Abolition Apostles Church, this was their idea. And it's just such a brilliant idea to start this free hospitality house near Angola. It's extremely isolated. You might have to drive for 40 minutes from the nearest town to get there. They're trying to found this place that's like very close by this old farmhouse and turn it into like a hub for activists, a way for family to get close to their people. I mean, a lot of people get life there and they're lucky to get to see their family a few times during their sentence. And, you know, of course, the sentencing is so racist that the whole system is so racist, especially in Louisiana. Like, you know, nobody deserves to be in that kind of a jail, but the levels of injustice, like all the way through the system, it's very extreme.
Well, I hope that the kind of fundraising project reaches the goal. It's a massively ambitious fundraising target, isn't it?
It is, but we're just, you know, we're trying to get this down payment together. And then there'll be ongoing fundraising. So after this project, we'll go into visual art and then try to make the musical benefit happen once a year. And like, hopefully even on the land, you know, in person, when we can be around each other again. In Angola, there's people who've served 30 and more years on trumped up charges, and they're still fighting for their freedom. And, you know, going before racist parole boards and trying to prove their innocence. there's people who even had like a lot of support from their wardens and still couldn't get out. I don't blame everybody who's, you know, working there. You know, there's that saying, you know, the prison guards are the ones who come back there every day. They get to leave, but they come back. Want to tell the ghost story now?
I've always been very frightened of ghosts.
Me too.
And I occasionally taunt my children with them if I'm trying to get control of them late at night.
You know, really?
I know it's awful. Yeah, yeah. That's what I said, you know, it's not, I'm not a brilliant, you know, I'm not an excellent character, you know. Yeah, we have a kind of ongoing story about the man in the walls, you know, but there's no one in the wall. My only ghost story of like actually kind of coming into close proximity to a ghost was when I was in Donegal with my mother and brother as a child, like very young child, and we were renting a, I think we were either staying in a bed and breakfast or renting a cottage from someone. And my brother said, who was that went into the, you know, who just came out of there to the lady who was like clearing it up or, you know, who met us. Then she took my mum to one side and said, there was no one in there at all. But, you know, there is there's a ghost of a little boy or whatever that runs around here. And so that was, so my brother, who was more kind of sensitive to these things than me, clearly saw it. But I didn't, you know, and I think that's always because, well, I don't know why. I mean, he's just more sensitive than me, I guess. But it was pretty, it freaked us out, you know, and.
Yeah. And your brother was younger, right?
No, older, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, a year older than me. But yeah, he's always had a sort of a bit more. I mean, my mum was quite sort of, she would go to clairvoyance and stuff. My mum was quite kind of into that, and she used to dress up as a fortune teller and tell people's fortunes at our school fete. She used to feel that she could kind of sense things and communicate with ghosts and stuff, or well, specifically my father, I think. Yeah, which just kind of gives it a kind of more of a sad thing. Yeah, I was always like, whenever anyone mentions ghosts, I'm like, So I think maybe that kind of fear just obliterates sensitivity towards it.
If ghosts are real, I hope that my fear of them keeps them the fuck away from me. That's my tactic, and I think it mostly works.
Yeah, and yet you're quite obsessed with ghost stories, aren't you?
Well, I just I collected hundreds of firsthand ghost stories, so I like telling them. I like telling them because they're mostly not scary. And I just think they're amazing human stories.
Yeah. Still, I am surprised that you're attracted towards telling stories about something that like you're intrinsically scared of. But then again, maybe the things that we are all scared of are the things that we weirdly attract into our lives in a weird way. You know, like not wanting to run away from things, you end up colliding with them, possibly.
Well, I wanted information about them. You know, I wanted to look for commonalities. I just wanted to understand. So I had undiagnosed PTSD for, you know, as long as I can remember. And that, you know, you just have kind of like that can manifest as like a cloud of anxiety or something, you know, like, or panic attacks, nightmares, insomnia, those kind of symptoms. And because it was undiagnosed and because I didn't know what I was afraid of as a kid, ghosts were almost like a a symbol for me. It was just like a way that I could explain my PTSD symptoms. And I've gotten better healthcare in the past 15 years or whatever. And, you know, I've been able to give myself a break from being constantly triggered like I was before I knew what my symptoms were, before I understood PTSD. So I no longer conflate that nebulous anxiety of PTSD. I no longer like think, oh, well, maybe I'm afraid because of something supernatural. You know, I know exactly why I experience anxiety now. But I still collected all these really cool stories. And to me, they're like dreams. You know, they're very human. They're very human stories. They're just like, and the meaning is only with the person who's experienced them. That's how I think of it. And so, you know, talking to people about these stories is like doing dream analysis.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And it's, you know, sounds like it was like collecting them as somehow part of dealing with the worries that, you know, that you had when you were a kid. Mm-hmm. But have you ever heard about, like, Hillary was telling me a few, maybe I wanted to talk to you about it, like a few weeks ago or maybe a month ago, the song lines, you know, and the dream state and all that. Have you come across all that? The kind of Aboriginal songwriting that can, and the songs can last for days.
Right. The songs are almost like maps of the country.
Yeah. Amazing, yeah. Isn't it?
It's like, really beautiful. I mean, it's like
a song, you find your way across huge terrain. And, you know, the song reveals like where you turn left and right or whatever, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it called the dream state? So there's a dream state in there somewhere. You know, I'm not sure because I'd never heard of it before. But I was like, wait.
I think, you know, like, and obviously this is, you know, in English. And who knows, like, I don't know if this is like an acceptable term to Aboriginal people, but we say dream time. And I don't exactly know the meaning of that, but I have heard about the song lines. And I remember hearing people say like, oh, it makes the journey faster.
It's called, like, here it's called the dreaming and referred to as dream time.
Cool.
Devised by early anthropologists attributed Australian Aboriginal beliefs.
It's really cool learning about descriptions of time that are outside of the way we've been encultured to conceive of time.
I mean, there were some wilder ghost stories that I heard, but I just don't believe them, or not necessarily that I don't believe them. I mean, they haven't materialized in reality enough for me to think of them when you ask what, you know, your ghost story is. The school I was at, there was the guy who's, it was all based in someone's house, you know, who was like a kind of 18th century, you know, Scottish lord or whatever. And he apparently sold his soul to the devil. So then, like, he built himself another house because he was worried that he would get trapped by the devil at some point.
Mm.
So he built it in a circle, and it's called Round Square. So no matter where he went, you know, the devil could never corner him. That was the idea. So this is where I, like, so when I was at school, I didn't live in the Round Square or whatever, but I just, these were the stories that we all heard. But apparently he got caught by the devil somewhere else anyway, you know, on his way towards this tiny little church on the school grounds. So, but whether or not that's true, you know, this doesn't have that feeling of immediate truthfulness, you know, that my brother's story has. You know, I know for sure that all those dialogues were real, whereas the other one sounds more like the premise of a sort of falsely constructed but compelling horror film. You
exactly.
know?
Yeah. Well, there's so much mythology around how to trick the devil. And a lot of it is, it sounds so silly. It's like if you throw out a bag of poppy seeds, the devil has to count them all. So you'll have time to get away. But, you know, it's all just these folk tales. And have you heard the one about the superstition, like if you spill salt, you should throw it behind your shoulder because the devil is there?
I often do throw a bit of salt behind my shoulder, I must admit.
But do you do it when you spill salt? Because that's the superstition I grew up with.
No, actually, I don't. I just do it when I've taken some salt and there's too much.
I like that. I like that translation. And then, of course, you know, there are so many different Satans. You know, there's, I feel like the Jewish Satan is kind of like a comedian who works with God, and like they have their little shtick, and like the, you know, Satan is kind of, God is sort of like the straight man or something like that. And that's not, I mean, Satan isn't seen that way, say in like evangelical circles. The devil is almost seen as like a competing God, and that like if you give him too much power, he'll wreck more havoc or something, you know, and that's how you get people being so mad about Lil Nas's shoes. There's this crazy house here in California called the Winchester Mansion. It was also architecture built to confuse evil spirits. Another way we could think of it is that this woman had too much money, and this contractor was just trying to get jobs for his cousins, and he could keep telling her a good story and she kept paying for it. But there's like stairways that lead nowhere. She inherited all this money from this rifle. It was like dirty gun money. And she was convinced that the souls of people who died by gun violence were going to come get her. So this is the only two bits of architecture that were designed to confuse evil spirits. So if anybody knows of any others, let us know in the comments. Thank you for being part of Abolition 2021 benefit, and thank you for coming on the Ghost Story Salon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real ride.
It's always so good to talk to Daniel Edelston. He really made me feel seen as an artist in that conversation. Daniel has a band called Orchestra of Cardboard. They have an upcoming record. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but Stevie Weinstein Voner, my partner, and I both worked on it. I'm really excited about it. I want to thank my producer, Rob Van Vranken, and thank you all for being here.